2021 is that the proportion of inmates with significant medical conditions is increasing faster than the general inmate population. And this slide amply points that out. If you look at our increase in population since December 2002 to July 2006, you see about a 10% increase in population. In that same period of time, we experienced a 240% increase in mental health population inmates, a 75% increase in inmates who needed dialysis, a 70% increase in inmates who needed had respiratory diseases, a 74% increase in inmates with cardiovascular disease, and probably the main reasons for those huge increases are corresponding increases in the age of our inmate population. For example, if you look at the number of inmates between the age of 50 and 59, that has gone up 27% in that same period of time. If you take a little step further and go into age 60 and above, that has gone up 42%. According to a 2004 report by the National Institute of Corrections, which is a branch of the United States Department of Justice, the annual cost of incarcerating inmates over 50 years old is estimated to exceed $60,000 per inmate compared to about $27,000 for others in the general population. I should like to point out that in Oregon, we're below that national average of 27%. We're right around $24,468. Please turn to slide 22.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Wesley.
Obviously, the stat that jumps off the page on 21 is mentally ill up 240%. Is this kind of like the lead system back in the 70s when they finally got some good, consistent, uniform data, uniform crime statistics? Same amount of crime, really, but just better reporting. Is this just reflect a increased sensitivity of all of us, including the department, to mental illness issues? And that's staggering.
Chair Shields and Senator Westland, we believe that it's largely related to a decreasing in mental health services in the communities throughout the state of Oregon over the last probably six to eight years. We think that that's manifested itself through time in more inmates going to jail for lesser offenses. And once they go to jail a couple times, then they end up getting longer sentences, and they end up in the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just chime in for the record, Max Williams, Department of Corrections. Senator Westland, that's a similar question that I asked as I started to see this data early on as the director and saw the comparative increases. And so I have asked those specific questions. Did we change the instruments that we're using to sort of conduct that pre-screening to categorize? And the answer I got back is actually we haven't, that we were still doing the same sort of intake evaluation and categorizing people with significant mental illnesses. The categories that you see there represent a broad category of mentally ill, but all of those categories require receiving services. And those of you who attended the tour heard when we were in the special management unit inside the penitentiary, we do prioritize and rank mental illness based on different kinds of diagnosis and the situation of the individual inmate. So there are severe categories and persistent categories and then lower categories that still require treatment but may not be needing the same level of services. This is a broad measure of those within the system that probably reaches down to the moderate level of mentally ill who still require some sort of service, probably at least on a weekly basis, and are likely on some sort of prescription medication within the system.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland, yes.
Just a comment. Stan, as you were talking and saying, okay, really, a big part of this is lack of services in the community, is driven by lack of services in the community. You should know that Mary Botkins, who knows this budget as well as anybody, was in the back row going,
So,
Chair Shields, collaborating your testimony.
Chair Shields and Senator Westland, thank you for sharing that.
It's always good to have Mary Green with you, you know what I mean?
We could have a beer up here.
I would like that to be the case, however. And was there another question?
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Burdick.
On the subject of older inmates, you quoted a figure of $60,000 as opposed to $24,000 or $25,000 for a regular inmate. How much of that $60,000 cost do you think is attributable to the challenges of caring for geriatric or older, that's what we call it, geriatric?
Yeah, thanks, Senator Burdick.
Well, I've lived a better life, I hope. how much of that would you say would
be... Turn the mic, by the way.
How much of that would you say would be attributable to the challenges of providing health care within a prison setting? In other words, what I'm trying to get at is, could these costs be brought down if there were more alternative settings for people to be located in, aside from the maximum or minimum or medium security setting?
Chair Shields and Senator Burdick, we are looking at that very, very subject right now. As a matter of fact, in the Madras institution, there will be a unit for geriatric inmates, and we do hope to use that as part of a cost control strategy to contain costs and provide as many services as we possibly can within the institution. The reality is, though, that as inmates get older, and because of their prior lifestyles, they're much older than their chronological age would suggest, they do come with them. They do tend to have much higher incidence of hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, respiratory illnesses, arthritis, and a whole list of fairly serious ailments. And in many cases, we will still have to take those type of inmates out in the community and pay a higher cost for treatment.
And Mr. Chairman, this leads to a follow-up, and that is, would it be possible to protect public safety with some of these people? I mean, how many of these people are so ill that they're incapable of committing crimes? Could there be another setting aside from a prison setting that they could be moved to and still protect public safety, something lower cost, ideally something where they could be put on programs that aren't 100% Oregon taxpayer funded?
Chair Shields and Senator Burdick, I think that right at this point in time, I'm not so sure that the numbers are great enough to justify having a setting just for that purpose. That's something we certainly are going to be taking a look at and are taking a look at. I know some states have actually got their own licensed corrections hospitals, but they've got much larger inmate populations that can support that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could comment, there is a process by which when someone is essentially medically so infirmed that they can apply for a program that allows them to release back out to the community, often the requests come in for somebody who's at an end-of-life stage potentially. And there is a review committee that includes our medical director and medical services people, and also a security review that's done on those cases. And the recommendation is then made to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, who has that statutory authority. I can tell you in the number of years that I've been the director, it has been very rare, I think maybe only on one or two occasions, where the recommendation from that review committee has recommended that we go ahead and make that determination. And it's usually when somebody is non-ambulatory. And much of that is a review of their past case history and the severity of the crimes they committed. And unfortunately, one of the challenges we have with this environment is that because someone might be in the system who has dementia, given the nature of the crime they may have committed, it doesn't necessarily mean they're any less dangerous because they're less capable, either mentally or even in some cases somewhat physically incapacitated. They still have potential risks associated with them. So we're very cautious about that. There certainly is an approach one could consider about a secured facility, but the moment that you put the security around it, you lose the opportunity, for example, to fall back into the Medicaid pool and get federal Medicaid dollars to help pay for that individual's care because they're still technically incarcerated. So it's a bit of a balancing issue, and obviously our mission being first and foremost a public safety one, we take very seriously those security risks of posing a new threat to the community by letting somebody out.
And Mr. Chairman, final follow-up. If there, and I know this is a very limited process, but there is, as we get an increasing population from Measure 11 mandatory sentences, is there anything in Measure 11 that would keep you from using that process in the limited circumstances you use it now?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, I don't believe that the individuals who are subject to a Measure 11 sentence would be, if I recall how that works, they would not be allowed to go out. So it's only people who have been in either under long-term matrix sentences or non-Measure 11 sentences who would probably qualify for that kind of internal review, because we don't have the statutory authority to actually reduce any of a Measure 11 sentence by returning someone to the community.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Stan, as you portray these numbers, I mean, I'm kind of due to math. You got 27% of the total population identified with mental illness. Will we see a corresponding cost of treatment? That, I mean, we're looking here that, you know, you had a 240% increase in the mentally ill. The total population is about 27% of your total. Are we going to see a treatment number that matches that? I mean, have we been able to keep up with treatment compared to the number of folks you have in that capacity?
Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, we will be presenting later on in this presentation two budget option packages that will address the very issue that you're talking about.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I heard a reference in the response to the previous question about federal Medicaid, but I was wondering about Medicare or other income or other resources or federal payments that are potentially applicable. Are there any other resources coming in or that could be captured except for some sort of federal or state rule that's preventing it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, if I'll take a stab at trying to answer that question. Max Williams again for the record. Federal government with respect to any of those types of programs has been pretty clear with the states that they do not cover any incarcerated populations. So to the extent that someone is in the care or custody of either a jail or a prison, in a custody environment, that they're not entitled for any of that. And Mr. Wilson, having worked at DHS earlier in his history and been involved in that, probably knows the details of those rules and regulations much better than I do. But there is no the small amount of federal funds we do get are the primarily related to the state alien assistance money, in other words, the costs associated with, or some reimbursement costs associated with offenders who are criminal aliens being held within the prison system. But that's the sole amount of federal money. And I'm not aware of a system in the country who's figured out a way to actually get any kind of federal Medicare or Medicaid money into the system.
To follow up on that, Mr. Williams, it seems like last biennium there was $4 million and you weren't sure if you were going to get for that program. Did you end up getting that? And I know you're still unsure whether or not you're going to get it this biennium. Do you have any sense of that?
Mr. Chair, we have received a partial payment on the federal SCAP money. I don't believe that the second payment that's supposed to come hasn't been received, and we haven't gotten final notification about the amount yet for the remainder of the biennium. So that's still hanging out there to some degree, even for this biennium. And my understanding is that the SCAP money was not included in the president's budget, but it typically isn't, and Congress usually puts it back in at some point. So we're anticipating that there'll be money in the next biennium.
Thank you.
Hey, Chair Shields and members of the committee, on slide 22, you'll see some of the drivers that basically would be characterized as inflationary costs that cause the cost of treatment to continually rise. It has been estimated that for the next biennium, the cost of medications, pharmaceuticals, will go up about 13.9%, and the cost for medical inflation projected, just in general, will be 17%. In addition, the cost of hospital specialists, special procedures, et cetera, which we anticipate will continue to rise. And I want to give you an example of a recent inflationary rise in a medication that's very, very common. It's a inhaler for asthma called albuterol. Up until several months ago, we paid $2.62 per unit for a inhaler. But due to increased regulations for ozone-friendly propellants, the cost of albuterol has now gone in just a, I mean, literally just a couple months' time, from $2.62 per unit to $29.35 per unit. That's about an 11-fold increase. Along with that, all types of medical supplies and equipment continues to rise price-wise. And in addition, we're continually faced with new medications that are coming on the market that become the standard of care that also usually bring with them, in addition to claimed effectiveness, better effectiveness, they also bring with them higher costs. I'll give you an example. About 5 years ago, with the medications that were available, it would cost us about $25 a day to treat HIV, inmates with HIV. And to give you some idea about how many inmates we have that are like that, we have currently about 50 in the system. That cost, 5 years later, has gone up to $60 a day. So we're talking $25 a day 5 years ago, $60 a day now. And to give you an idea what that translates to for those 50 inmates, that just for those 50 inmates alone, that's about a $2.2 million bill. Another example would be antipsychotic medications, whereas just a few years ago we could spend 30 cents a pill for a medication known as Haldol. Well, since that time, there's been a whole new generation of antipsychotics. In fact, they call them atypical antipsychotic medications that are supposedly more effective. Again, they bring with them a much higher price tag. So we're talking about a pill that we used to be able to use that cost us 30 cents a day, and now we're looking at medications that are in the range of between $8 and $16 a day. And one final example is the treatment of leukemia. Currently, we only have 5 inmates in our system that have leukemia, but the treatment per each one of those inmates is between $33,000 and $66,000 a year. If you add that up, that's between, over the course of a biennium, that's between $330,000 and over $600,000 just to treat 5 inmates that have leukemia within the Department of Corrections. Please turn to slide 23.
Just a moment, please, Mr. Senator Wesson.
Stan, you made a comment with regard to the psychotropics, the Haldol, and you said, you know, we've got these new drugs and they are supposedly more effective. You know, in your environment, I think that would be pretty easy to determine. I mean, you got 24/7 supervision. You keep records on all these guys. I mean, is it more effective, or is it not, or is it indeterminate?
Chair Shields and Senator Westland, what we do with our, particularly with our mental health type medications, we pick the medication. We try to start out with the medication that has some evidence based data behind it that it has some effect, that it is effective. And if that doesn't work, then we go to the next least expensive medication. Perfect. Again, that has some sort of evidence behind it that it does work. My example is just to show you that the whole field of medications is continually evolving. At some point in time, there's a determination made whether or not that becomes the standard level of care. And that's kind of an elusive target. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that as we go along.
I'll wait for that. Thank you.
Please turn to slide 23. I want to talk about three types of variables that control the cost measures that we pay in health services. Those are those variables that we cannot control or have very, very, very little control over. Those measures that have some, that we have some limited control over, and those measures that we have a fair amount of control over. Please turn to slide 24, and I'll talk about the variables that the Department of Corrections essentially cannot control. The first is we have no control over the health and numbers of inmates who are directed to the care of the Department of Corrections. Whatever is sent to us by the courts and whatever ailments they bring with them, then we are obligated to treat that. Along with that, the Constitution requires that we provide, a standard level of care, community standard level of care. We have very little control over that. The whole subject about community standard of care...
Just a question. Are we talking about the federal Constitution or the state Constitution when we're referring to the Constitution?
Chair Shields and Representative Cameron, we're talking about the United States Constitution.
The Eighth Amendment?
Yes.
Thank you.
Getting back to the community standard of care, that is almost like a continually moving target. Again, as new medications, as new procedures are developed, as new thresholds come across that basically suggest that, well, we need to start treating this type of ailment sooner than we used to, or we need to start treating this kind of type of ailment that we didn't used to treat at all. And that's further complicated by court interpretation of a community standard of care. And I'll give you an example of that. In the past, we felt, to our best judgment and reading the literature and some of the previous court cases, that there were certain types of hernia operations that we felt to be elective and that we were not going to provide to inmates. The courts got involved in some of those cases and disagreed with us and basically suggested very strongly that we settle those cases and provide those operations. Now, just to give you an idea what that means, each time we have to provide that type of a hernia operation, that's about $10,000 per procedure. Please turn to slide 25. And I'd like to talk to you about some of the variables over which the department does have some limited control over. The first I'd like to discuss has to do with decisions about medical necessity. Certainly there are types of rhinoplasty or different types of nasal reconstruction procedures that may have a medical necessity tied into them that we may have to perform those type of operations. However, for a strictly cosmetic type of a surgery, we would not perform that type of surgery. So we do have some say over the type of procedures we provide. And there's a whole list of those. Also, we have some control over the location where care will be delivered. As I mentioned earlier, where at all possible, we will try to provide medical care of whatever we can within our capability and within our expertise within a correctional institution where we can better control costs. We can also reduce the security risk to the public. The final area where we do have some control over is we do, in fact, negotiate rates with hospitals and with specialists, and we've been able to be successful. I'll talk a little bit more about that also later to give you some idea what that looks like. Please turn to slide 26.
Before we move on to that, you talk about how you don't have any control of the pre-existing conditions the inmates have, but once they get into the institution, I'm sure you do your best to try to keep people from getting sick through wellness programs of some sort. Could you comment about that so that the committee has an understanding of that?
Chair Shields, I'm glad you brought that up because, yes, we are pretty, I would say we're pretty active in trying to catch inmates' diseases and illnesses and ailments as early on so that we can treat them before they become major events, and in some cases, particularly with contagious diseases, we want to catch those early on so they don't spread to the rest of the population, also to infect our staff.
I saw those deep fryers in the kitchen. Vegetable oil in there. Senator Brown.
Chair, while we're at a little break here, I guess my question is, I'm assuming that other correction systems around the country are facing the same kind of issues, and I just wonder what kind of discussions you were having with the state of Washington or whoever else it is to see what they're doing that might be new and unique to kind of reduce some of these costs or
look at it a little differently or that sort of thing.
Chair Shields and Senator Brown. Yes, we approach that in several ways. One is we try to within our budget and trying to be manage our budgets as best we can. But we do try to send our medical providers to conferences where they interface and network with healthcare professionals from all over the country. And those are the very kinds of issues that are, in addition to medically prescribed procedures and that kind of thing, they do certainly talk about cost containment. I think some of the other stuff that we do is we compare our costs with what we see in other states, and we've compared pretty favorably. I'm going to share some of that data with you, too, okay. In just a little while. The next issue I'd like to discuss are those cost control measures where we have, and I hate to use the word retain control over because I don't know that we retain control over everything in an absolute sense, but we retain a lot of control over. We operate our health services much like an HMO in that we attempt to deliver quality care while seeking every opportunity to control costs. Some of the things that we do to do that is we have systems of delivering health services. We prioritize the limited list of health, dental, mental health coverage, and pharmaceuticals. We have guidelines for treatment and use of diagnostic services, and we also use a physician's committee to look at each case before we send an inmate out into the community for community health care. In mental health, we have guidelines for prescribing psychiatric medications, and that's much like Senator Westland's question around, we try to start with the least expensive evidence-based medication before going to the next medication. We also operate a centralized pharmacy with our own staff and formulary, which has proven to be much more cost-effective than trying to contract those services out to a private provider. In addition, the Department of Corrections is a member of the Minnesota Multi-State Contracting Alliance for Pharmacy, which consists of 42 participating states, and they're able to combine the purchasing power of all these states to reduce the cost of medications to the Department of Corrections. Finally, I don't know that how many of you are aware of this, we do charge inmates for services that include the purchase of glasses, dentures, and prosthetics in those cases where inmates are able to help pay for those items. Now, to give you an idea what that has resulted in over the course of this particular biennium, so far we have collected about $250,000 for those items. Now, in the case of an inmate who would need a pair of glasses or some of these other items that was indigent, that couldn't pay for those, and we felt that they needed them, then we would, in fact, pay for those costs. Please turn to slide 27.
Just a moment. Stan.
Thank you, Chair Shield. Stan, I'm a bit perplexed, I guess. You can charge for a few of those things. What about inmates who have assets or that could be paying for their medical care, other medical care? I mean, dentistry and all the other. I mean, how do you pick out the ones you just mentioned that they pay for if they have assets and they don't pay for any other cost of medical care?
Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, what we do is we have a list of those items that we will charge inmates for, and typically they are glasses and they are prosthetics and some dentures and things like that. We have not at this point in time, although we are studying the possibility of expanding that, at this point in time we have not expanded that to other medical procedures.
Follow up. So, I mean, the fact that you're, I think, going to study it says there must be some legality. It must be legal in some way, shape, or form if you can prove they have assets to cover some of those costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, again for the record, Max Williams, if I could jump in here. The issue, there is a statute that was passed by the legislature some while ago that allows us to do some cost of care recovery for individuals that can demonstrate the assets. And the challenge, I think, has been for the department, which sort of got the statute passed, but the mechanism by which that was done was really not identified by statute. Somewhat like, you know, some agencies can roll back to the Department of Revenue and you can, you know, catch the stuff out of somebody's, you know, tax return in similar situations. It's been a bit of a challenge from an implementation standpoint. We've been working with the Department of Administrative Services on that. By and large, the overwhelming majority of this population doesn't have that level of resources. So the recovery that we're talking about on these situations is small charges, a couple of hundred dollars, for example, for a pair of eyeglasses that are better than just, you know, sort of the, you know, black frame standard issue. If an inmate wants to acquire those, then they've got to use their own resources in order to do that. And those resources would come out of the inmate's trust account. They could either be provided to the inmate by family, or they would be the conversion of the inmate's points from their work in some place within the system. And they could choose to, you know, if they want the glasses with the frames that they're more interested in having, they could choose to use their resources to buy that instead of something else off of the standard canteen list, for example. So it's that kind of recovery, and it is primarily for those essential at sort of the level would provide indigent, but if you're not indigent and you've got some resources and you're working within the prison environment and building up a base, then we would charge you for those, and maybe you pay for them over time to recover that value.
One more follow-up in this area.
Right.
Thank you, Chair Shield.
Got 2 weeks.
It piques my interest, though, and I question then, how about an inmate who is married with a spouse working in the private or public sector outside your walls that's covered by health insurance and could be covering their spouse? Would you have the ability to seek remuneration from that insurance policy, health insurance policy?
Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, this is an area that I don't know a lot about from a legal standpoint, but I have had in one instance in my directorship bumped into this issue because of an inquiry from someone I actually knew prior to becoming the director who wanted to ask me this question. And it's my understanding that generally health insurance policies specifically exclude the coverage of individuals, even if they had been covered under the policy, while they are under incarceration.
Feel free. I'm sorry, but that just begs another question.
Is it state or federal law that we need to change?
Well, not only that, but to the point, if it just says while they're under incarceration, what about the person driving down the road who, you know, just gets thrown in jail for the weekend? Does that mean for the weekend they're not covered by their health insurance policy?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, I don't run jail, so I can't answer that question definitively, but my guess is if they needed health care during the period of time they were in the jail over the weekend, that by and large that would not be a cost recoverable against their insurance policy, and that the county's budget would likely, whatever their health system would likely have to pay those funds. It's my understanding how it works. Now, I also want to point out, I don't know that we've ever done any analysis, but I would also suggest to the committee, before we spend a lot of time walking down this path, the vast majority of people who are walking into prison by the time they have arrived in prison no longer have any kind of health insurance coverage and have very little in the way of assets that would be recoverable. So we're talking about a very small percentage of individuals that you would be directly able to pursue and recover any kind of assets. And remember that we get people after they've gone through a trial, after they've typically paid their lawyer, if they've been able to have one or if the state's already provided one, it's indicative of the lack of assets that they have in that respect. And they've spent some period of time, often several months, in a county jail before they ever arrive at the front door of the prison. So to the extent they may have had some level of health insurance through an employer or something like that before that happened, they won't have it by the time they arrive in the Department of Corrections in the vast majority of cases.
I think we can probably, when the counties come to testify, they can tell us whether or not they can have insurance coverage there in the jails. Was there a question over here? Let me do Senator Burdick, and I'll come back to Representative Nathanson.
Some time ago, the prison went smoke-free, prison system went smoke-free. Is that entirely smoke-free, or are there places where the inmates can smoke?
Chair Shields and Senator Burdick, inmates are not allowed to smoke at any place within our prisons or on work crews outside of our prisons.
So my question is, have you noticed any, how long has the policy been in effect, and have you noticed any positive impact on your health care costs?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, I asked Mr. Cerny if I could tell a story. I think it was in 96, 97 that the department moved, and it moved in stages. It went from no smoking inside any structures to no smoking outside to eventually being entirely smoke-free in all the institutions. It also had the effect of making tobacco the number one contraband item inside
That's true.
Department. So more contraband came in forms of tobacco, which, you know, is not necessarily a bad thing as compared to other contraband items, but it certainly created a secondary market for tobacco products with inside the prison system because of the strong addictive quality of tobacco. One of the doctors in our system did tell me, though, that as a result of that change, in the time period when inmates were allowed to smoke, particularly in their cells, that there was often in some areas just almost a blue cloud kind of hung over those housing units that you visited. And the number of cases for outside medical visits of people who were asthmatic having attacks dropped significantly as we moved to a smoke-free environment. So along with the general health benefits that you have from limiting people's access to tobacco anyway, there's been that secondary effect, I think, in respiratory ailment issues where we've had less transports and outside the system health context from people going into any sort of respiratory distress by clearing the air inside those institutions. So it's, I don't know that we get specific measurements, but at least the anecdotal information that I've gotten back from some of our health services people say that we have seen sort of a double benefit as a result of getting rid of tobacco inside the system.
Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is related to that. We understand from your testimony and from our visit and so forth that there's a lot you have to deal with in the healthcare system that you don't have control over. You've just mentioned the status of the person's health when they arrived at prison. You don't have control over that. However, for someone who's going to be with you for a few years or for a long time, there is some influence then over general wellness. And so whether there's a tobacco-free policy, that has some influence. Well, so does nutrition. So I was wondering, in part following up on a question from earlier today, to what extent are nutritional factors evaluated for cost effectiveness in the long term when we think about the cost of the cost to someone's health as well as the cost to the system to deal with cardiovascular disease, cholesterol medication, and so forth? What are you doing in the area of nutrition that is really beneficial and cost effective?
Chair Shields and Representative Nathanson, we do have a licensed dietitian on board who does prescribe a nutritionally sound diet for the inmate population.
I wanted to ask you another quick question. When we get to the transition portion, I'll ask that.
Okay.
Please feel free to continue.
Okay. Chair Shields and the committee, what you have before you in slide number 27 are just some of the cost control measures that we have in place in medical services. And I'm not going to go through every one of those, but just to give you a couple key examples, if you were an individual in the community and you had to have a reading on a lumbar x-ray and you didn't have insurance, you'd have to pay $30 for that reading. We are able to get that through negotiation, that price down to $6.75. And just to drop down to medications, because we are a member of the Minnesota Multi-Purchasing Consortium that I talked to you about, we are able to get our medications at 75% of wholesale when compared to an individual out in the community who didn't have insurance would have to pay the full retail price. In terms of hospital rates, because of our negotiating with providers throughout the state, we are able to get a charge ratio of between 75 and 80% of the rate that a private citizen would get. And all, one of the more telling, I think, cost-saving measures we've been able to affect has to do with the dialysis treatment of inmates. If you were to get that same treatment in the community, the cost would be around $2,600. We're able to get that for $814 by having a dialysis unit located on-site at one of our institutions, and we're soon to expand that to the Coffee Creek Correctional Institution for Women.
Stan, before you go on, I asked if, when we did our prison tour whether or not DHS also takes part in that same Minnesota multi-state. If you could look into that and get back to me, I sure would appreciate it.
Sure, we will do that. Please turn to...
My understanding is the state hospital does.
They do.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just in comment to that, Mr. Wilson would likely know more about that than we would. But, so if you're comfortable with his answer,
that's
then
true.
We'll let that stand. If you'd like us to pursue it, we can pursue it with DHS. But
I would like somebody to pursue it. So, and I just want to make get an answer, particularly for the health committees too, that if there's a way that we can bring all of those together, I'd like to explore it. And if there's a logical reason why we can, I'd like to know that too.
Great. Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, we included in Mr. Zerniak's presentation the key performance measures that the operations division has responsibility for. They're the same key performance measures that I reviewed with the committee on the first day. And it was with the committee's permission, would like to maybe jump to slide 35. This is a proposed key performance measure that, related to health services that would like to at least have the committee entertain some discussion about.
Yeah, colleagues, I think since Max hit a lot of the key performance measures early on, we are going to definitely, particularly when it comes to the POPs, going to work with the department to make sure we have strong outcome measures that justify those. So before we go to work session, and as most of you know, this will probably be one of the last budgets that we end up passing. So I do feel comfortable passing by those that have already been covered, if you all do. Senator Brown?
Mr. Chair, I was not here, I believe, for this discussion, but I would just be curious as to sort of costs involved with complying with Measure 17, if you can give me that information.
Measure 17 compliance costs.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, we will try to do. We'll try to figure out how to do that. I think that we're obviously Measure 17 and the work and programs component requirements now over time have become so integrated into our overall operation that it may be difficult to split them out. I think we could probably make some rough estimates about, to the extent that it's required, additional staffing to support some of those work areas and some things like that. We could probably identify some issues there.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure whether we've ever looked at the cost effectiveness of this ballot measure, and so that's really my question of, I don't know what the purpose was other than we didn't want folks sitting around, you know, eating bonbons and watching TV, and I just don't have a sense of whether the time and energy we put into it, its results.
Mr. Williams, may I also suggest that might be a nice one to punt over to Mr. Kilgore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, unfortunately, he only employs a small percentage of the overall DOC population, and we're required to have all of them to the extent we can. And so most of the people who work and are doing work or programs inside are not under the organization enterprises, but are doing various job assignments like working in kitchens and the like throughout all of the institutions.
Fixing whole wheat bread and oatmeal.
Some of those, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, some of those, obviously, those people would be working regardless. I will say that while we continue to struggle to meet the compliance numbers for a variety of factors that I talked about on our opening day, we do believe that there's generally a positive outcome as a result of having people employed in pro-social kinds of activities, whether they be work or and/or programming. And idleness remains one of the great challenges in operating in a prison system. And the fewer people you have idle, The better off you are from a safety and a security standpoint and a general overall sense of people feeling like they're accomplishing something even while they're doing time. So, but it did have a cost associated with it. There's little doubt about that.
Yeah, if you just do the best you can and sometime before we go to work session, try to at least write up something. Cool. And then with all the questions, Max, you've been very good at bringing me information, but in the future, get it dug and we'll distribute them all.
Right, we're building packets of all of the, we keep a good list of all your questions and we're building responses to all of them that we'll share with you as we get them done.
Right, thanks.
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, thank you. So, Max, when we're talking about Measure 17, we were in the infirmary the other evening and you pointed out the long-term care area where you actually have a group of inmates that take care of those people over there. Would you be counting their hours that they're serving in that infirmary?
Yes.
In something like that?
Yes.
And,
yes.
And would when you do an analysis like that, the not only their hours that they're there, but the cost of nurses or whatever, who would replace them? I mean, those are the kinds of things we'd be talking about.
Yep.
To do this analysis.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cameron, we would orderlies who work in the infirmary as their duty assignment inside the institution, or inmates who have gone through the training to actually be hospice care providers for other inmates who are providing, you know, they're providing the end of life care. Those would be specific job assignments, and so that would qualify under Measure 17. So they are getting Measure 17 credit for performing those responsibilities. And to a great degree, the system uses a great deal of inmate labor, obviously, to keep itself functional and operational, whether it's kitchen staff or it's maintenance crews or it's a variety of things that happen inside that couldn't happen were it not for employing the inmates to perform those jobs. So in some ways, you could certainly do an offset and say if the inmate was only going to be in their cell for the whole time that they're there, look at all the other people you need to hire in order to run the system, but there's really no prison system that operates that way. We utilize that inmate labor to offset costs for cost containment purposes at every conceivable opportunity, but for where we think it creates issues related to security and safety, and that's the place where we draw the line.
Follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
Just maybe I need to be educated then. So what did Measure 17 force you to do other than those, I mean, those things that were already naturally within the system that we would want to, you know, look, as the senator asked about, measure what they cost us to do?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Cameron, I think what it did was it required us to both evaluate the level of inmate idleness inside the system and then to work harder and look for new opportunities to create work. Sometimes meaningful, more often than not meaningful, but to create work in order to obtain or to avoid that idleness. And in an effort to meet the constitutional obligations of Measure 17, one of the unfortunate things that I think happened early on is there was an effort to do that, to try to put more people working in an area where it wasn't safe to have them there. So if you needed 120 people to run a meal in one of the kitchens, you know, to meet your Measure 17 compliance, you know, you might try to put 200 people in there and they were tripping over themselves and creating an unsafe environment. And we've stepped back away from that. We're not willing to sacrifice institutional safety and security just to have people, you know, similarly, if the tier's been swept and it's clean, putting another guy out to sweep and clean it one more time, that's actually not a pro-social thing. It's actually causing the guy to think, gee, why am I doing a job that doesn't need to get done? And so we're stepping away from those kinds of approaches and trying to really focus on meaningful work. And to do meaningful work, it means that you actually have to have programs or opportunities for that to develop. And OCE, the Oregon Correctional Enterprises, is providing a chunk of that, obviously, by the things like the furniture factory and the GIS mapping and call centers and similar things that are going to translate into something more meaningful when somebody releases on the outside. And it's our effort to continue to develop those areas that probably overall have the greatest amount of long-term cost burden on the system.
Thank you.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, on slide 35, we have developed it's based on a 2005 recommendation by committee to the department that we propose a key performance measure in the area of medical services. And what we've proposed is that less than 1% of inmate health care encounters will occur outside of the secure perimeter of Department of Corrections facilities. One of the reasons that that is significant is that even though that's a 1% of all encounters that we have with inmates occurring outside, that does consume about 19% of our medical budget to go outside. And so what this literally does is give us a pretty good measure of how we're spending at least one out of five of our dollars in health care. Turn to slide 36, please. What I'd like to do is share with you some of the informal indicators, informal actually performance measures that we continue to keep track of through our Corrections Management of Information System. We keep track of the level of drugs use as measured by positive urinalysis tests, number of assaults, visits, misconduct hearings, weapons found, grievances filed, use of force incidents, escapes or attempts. We also keep track of demographics of the inmate population, such as mental health needs, educational level, age, ethnicity, and the percentage of high-risk inmates in each institution's population. In addition, we keep track of, we have a inmate non-cash incentive program, which really means that if you show pro-social behavior over an extended period of time, and don't get yourself written up for misbehaviors, you can earn it's a three-level system, you can earn another level. At each succeeding level, there are different privileges that are associated with those levels. That's part of our process to encourage pro-social behavior. We also manage or monitor grievances and our specialty training standards. There was a time in our system where we would train our special response teams differently depending on what institution they were located in. We have now standardized that training. And we're keeping track to make sure that we have a standard level of training for those teams. We're also monitoring overtime. We are involved in developing a business continuation plan to deal with natural disasters. As a part of that plan, we're also developing a pandemic plan that should be ready by next November. Please turn to slide 37. Some of the internal measures for health services include the percentage of non-critical off-site care that is peer-reviewed prior to being authorized, and that's by other doctors, overall cost of care as compared to correctional systems and health plans in neighboring states. And while I'm on that, I'd like to turn to slide number 38 and give you a comparison that is based on the Corrections Compendium. I think, Chair Shields, I heard you mention that document yesterday. This is volume 31, which was authored in October of 2006. It gives you a cost comparison of Oregon with five of our neighboring states. I would like to comment about the Corrections Compendium, although it is probably the only document of its type that makes an attempt to compare different dynamics within systems, such as use of forces, staffing ratios, cost comparisons for medical, and the like. We don't always exactly know what we're comparing. We're not always sure that we're comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges, because all states, or some states certainly, tend to count different types of phenomena differently. We do think, however, it is some sort of a baseline. It's probably the best baseline out there that gives us some comparison as how we're doing vis-a-vis other states. Please turn to slide 39.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You first.
I don't see California on here. They don't participate, or
they're off the charts.
Look at Washington.
Chair Shields and Senator Wilson, that is a good question, and my guess is they really are off the charts.
You got some court deal going on down there.
Yes, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilson.
As a matter of speaking, they probably do.
Not every state responds. So the way the compendium works is they send out a survey to state systems, they ask you to respond, and in some cases, states choose not to respond. While I don't specifically recall whether California did or didn't respond, it wouldn't surprise me if, given the involvement of the federal court litigation and everything else they've got going on down there with respect to the operation of their medical system being under a special court master, that they chose not to answer your questions. I might be wrong about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were not responsive on the survey. You can certainly get a copy and check.
Right. If I could add, Chair Shields, also my suspicion is that we try to compare ourselves to states that are relatively close to our size. California is so much huger, larger than our system.
And then I wanted to ask you a question. Washington has a number of private prisons. Is my impression correct? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, for the record again, Max Williams, DOC Director. I don't recall that they have. I know that Washington, because they have had a growth issue like we have, and they chose not necessarily to build in some cases. And so for a period of time, I know Washington inmates were being housed out of state in private prisons. So I believe they've got out-of-state private prison inmates housed in private prisons out of state. I don't recall that they specifically operate any private prisons in the state.
Could you check into that?
Yeah, sure.
If you could speculate on why you think their health care costs are so significantly higher than ours. Can you?
Sure, if you will try to get that information.
Oh, all right.
Sure. If you'll turn to slide 39, I'd like to talk about our first policy option package. Those of you that toured the penitentiary day before yesterday did go to the one of our special management units. We have another special management unit located at Snake River Correctional Institution. And to keep up with the number of severely mentally ill inmates that cannot function in an open population, we would like to increase the capacity of that program by 38 beds, and this would bring in a cost tag of about $861,000, and would fund several staff that you see on your chart before you.
Stan, can I just interrupt you real quick? I think when you asked us to jump to the states, then you passed over some of the internal measures. Would you mind if we revisited page 37 briefly?
I'm sorry, Chair Shields.
Okay. And the one thing I wanted to ask about that is that we had DOJ's budget in here not long ago, and there was maybe $40 or $50 million of general fund there, a lot of it going to defense of criminal convictions and the legal representation that they supply to you. And I know that you're going to be sitting down with Mr. Wilson to make some recommendations on KPMs. I was just hoping that you could take a look at that last one, which is inmate health care grievances per population, and try to figure out if there's a way that we could gauge how much we're spending on legal expenses for inmate lawsuits because of, or inmate complaints because of inadequate care, and so that we can keep an eye on that, because it makes a lot of sense to me, and I think everybody on this committee, that if we can invest in good care on the front end so that we're not getting having to pay 200 and, you know, or what was it, the hourly rate for DOJ? 128 an hour for legal expenses. I think we would be happy to make that investment if we could have a gauge of that.
Okay, Chair Shields, yes, and that is one area that we do intend to monitor. I'd also like to, since I'm back on this page, to point out that another one of our measures is the percentage of Department of Corrections health care clinics that are accredited by the National Commission on Correctional Healthcare. I can tell you, I'm happy to report to you that currently all but two of our prisons are fully accredited by that accrediting body. The one that's not accredited, the first one that's not accredited, is the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, because we had some problems meeting some of the timelines in the assessment process. We've corrected that now, and we're going up for accreditation in about a month. The other institution that's not accredited at this point in time is the Warner Creek Correctional Institution in Lakeview. And the reason for that is that before you can even enter into accreditation, you have to have at least 3 years in operation. They've only been in operation for about a year and a half, so they're going to be going through this in about a year and a half.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I want to go back to the slide on the annual health care expenditure. $3,000 per inmate at 13,000 inmates, that's $39 million, but our budget shows $140 million. Is that $3,000 per inmate, is that excluding staff, or I mean, where would be the differences in...
Could you walk us through what you're...
Well, I'm looking at the slide 30 on page 38 where we are comparing it to different states, and we're saying we're spending, I'm just using $3,000 per inmate, and I used a round number of 13,000 inmates, and that's $39 million. And I go back to, and this is obviously for 2007, for on page 13, medical services of $104 million. So I'm just trying to, I'm trying to come up with the difference between those numbers of $39 million versus $104 million in these graphs.
Right. Chair Shields and Representative Cameron, one of the things that I'm just going to have to take a stab at this until we get a chance to really check it out. It may not include dental costs. I'm not sure if it includes pharmacy costs. I'm not sure if there are some of the costs that we would include in our total health care delivery system may or may not be included, including mental health.
Okay.
So we'd have to check to find out what those figures mean.
Mr. Chair, that might be the Washington difference. They might include all that stuff in their numbers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, again, if I could jump in. Also, this is an annual, and the number that you're seeing is the biannual number. So if you times it by two, you're close to about $80 million. And the difference there might be an inclusion or a non-inclusion, something like pharmacy or mental health or dental or that number. So we can certainly disaggregate those numbers a little bit and respond to that question.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks.
I'd just point out that in the pie chart, the pharmacy is separated out.
Yeah. Right.
So it probably isn't pharmacy.
Right, that takes you another way. So, yeah, if you could look into it,
we'll just respond in the growing list
of questions. And as long as we're on healthcare, one thing that I want to tell you, the colleagues that I asked about is a lot of jails are, or at least 6 or 7 years ago, I'd read about a lot of jails asking inmates to pay just a modest amount for visits to the infirmary, you know, a dollar or something, just to make it tangible, and with the notion that that might slow down some of the visits. We discussed it, and I think they've tinkered with that, and they've decided that the benefit is really in making sure that people come in and get the services that they need so they don't get sicker. Is that kind of the summation?
Chair Shields, there is a debate throughout the country right now as to that very issue. There's one argument that says it does cut down sick call initially, but through time it rises back up. There's another argument, and I don't know that there's really a lot of hard data on this. There's another argument that, you can cut down your sick calls, but then you'll increase your emergency calls, and according to the course, you can't charge for emergency calls. The other argument is that if you charge a copay, you may encourage inmates who are a little sick to just hold off and not go pay the copay, and then get sicker and spread their contagious diseases around to other inmates, and then end up causing not only having to treat more individuals, but also when you do treat them, you're treating them when the disease has progressed to a more serious state. States do have it. It's very hard to get good hard data from those states on that, but we are taking a look at that.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay, I'd like to talk about Policy Option Package 100, which would be the expansion of the Special Management Unit at the Snake River Correctional Institution by 38 beds, which would give us better capability of dealing with those inmates who cannot mainstream in the open population. This policy package is important because without mental health treatment resources, mentally ill and low-functioning inmates are seldom able to make the type of responsible choices necessary to work and to also program. And they can be disruptive, they can be assaultive, and they can also be vulnerable to assault. And the way this particular package is tied to our own performance, key performance measures, is that in the first place, if an inmate has mental health problems that aren't treated, they obviously can't work and be in compliance with Measure 17. And not only just being in compliance with Measure 17, but also benefit from the work ethic that you learn by going through a work experience. And in some cases, you actually learn something that you can go out and apply in the community and maybe get a job. The second key performance measure that's related to this policy outcome package is the completion of the corrections plan. Again, if an inmate is got serious enough mental health problems, they're not going to be able to complete that corrections plan, which is designed, again, to mitigate the risk of future criminality. That, in turn, has a key effect on key performance measure number 3, which is the recidivism rate. If you send inmates out that you haven't fully treated for their mental health problems, they're not going to stand a very good chance of being successful back out in the community, and they're probably going to be coming back to us at a faster rate. And the other two that have to do with this package are key performance measure number 4, staff assaults, and key performance measure number 8, level 1 misconducts. Again, if we're not treating those kind of inmates, we can anticipate more assaults and more misconduct on the part of those inmates. Please turn to slide 40. I'd like to talk about policy option package number 101. This package provides permanent position authority and funding for mental health staff currently in temporary positions, and those positions are either double filled, in some cases even triple filled, as a result of the rapid growth of mental health inmates coming into our system during the current biennium. We frankly felt we could not keep up with the caseloads, with the staffing level that we had in mental health, and in fact we're running the risk of getting into that area where we're not providing a constitutionally mandated community standard of care to those inmates. This package here would permanently fund those. We also, in addition, ended two contracts that had to do with dual diagnosis treatment, at one at the Columbia River Correctional Facility and the other at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and took over operation of those programs with our own staff, cutting out some of the middlemen and some of the administrative costs associated with this, with those programs. To be able to do that, we had to do some double fills to provide the staff to manage those programs. And the way this links to our performance measures is very, very similar to what I just reviewed. And that is that if you don't provide the kind of mental health treatment that mental health inmates need, they're not going to be very successful with Measure 17 compliance. They're going to have a very difficult time being able to be in compliance with their corrections plans. This will, in turn, hamper the transition effort back out into the community and will, in all likelihood, result in a higher recidivism rate among those inmates. The staff assault level would be the same issue that I just talked about, as would the level 1 misconduct issue.
Mr. Chair, if I could also just comment on this. This is these positions are currently spread throughout the department in different locations, and they were positions that we felt like we needed to go forward with, even on a limited duration basis for the biennium, to ensure we were getting the level of care that that we felt was appropriate. So what this package is really asking you to do is to provide permanent funding for positions that the department this biennium found money within our budget to try to manage to address this critical need. And that's essentially what this policy option package does. So it doesn't add, it adds permanent position authority and financing, but it is not adding new bodies to the current mental health system that we're currently operating. It's taking people that we've currently got on those temporary and limited duration positions and making them permanent in our system.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Don't get me wrong, I think this is really important. I'm just curious, you mentioned lower recidivism rates, greater compliance with ballot measure 17, and less staffing issues. Do you have the numbers to show us? Is there a way to ID that?
Chair Shields and Senator Brown, we can show you that there are a number of inmates that are not able to work and that are not able to follow their corrections plan because of mental health issues. I don't have those numbers right with me, but we could try to come up with some sort of figures for you.
Okay.
And if I could perhaps piggyback on that, maybe if as part of the measure to justify those going forward, if we could compare, you know, you've certainly got more mental health inmates needing services than you have beds. Maybe we can compare those who get services to those who didn't have room for moving forward.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Brown, in policy option package 100, which was the additional SMU beds to add at Snake River, that's really to deal with this issue we have now with a very limited number of beds where we're often moving someone out of our special management unit and back into another population to make room for somebody who's in a more critical mental health state, having to get into the closest thing we've got to sort of a hospital-like therapeutic environment. In Package 101, these are providing a variety of mental health services across the department, serving a variety of levels of people, from the most critical to those people who are just at a basic level of needing a visit or participating in some sort of a group therapy and also getting prescribed their medication on some regular basis. And you can see the bulk of that are the 21 mental health specialists, so people who are certified mental health but lower level than psychiatrists or a psychologist providing those services. While we believe from a performance measure standpoint, and we're happy to do the work around that to demonstrate how it does have an impact on our key performance measures, I think the fundamental thing that I want to remind the committee about is these are not really optional services that we have an option of providing. Under the Eighth Amendment and Estelle v. Gamble, we have a constitutional obligation to not be indifferent to a person's pain, and the courts have deemed mental health issues as the same as medical inside an institutional environment. So it really is about meeting a minimum level of threshold standard, and we're happy to put all sorts of measurements around it. I just want to caution the committee that it really isn't something that from our perspective at least, is one of those things where we can choose tomorrow to do without putting both the department and the state of Oregon at some risk associated with those issues from both the litigation and just frankly a moral standpoint with respect to how we provide services to that large increasing mental health population.
But you will also admit that, I mean, there are different levels of acuity and you have to make some decisions based on that, and even this is not going to meet the entire need in the entire prison population.
Mr. Chairman, I can assure you that having sent the team who kept bringing me this policy option package back to the drawing board about 18 different times before I was willing to go forward with any mental health package, I can assure you this is not going to meet all the need. And so we're happy to try to determine some level of measurement on this issue. The challenge we always have in this situation is as we continue to see an increase in the number of mentally ill individuals coming into the system, measuring against that issue, we're always going to be sort of behind on even things like assaults. If we can keep up with the current population, but as we grow, that percentage of mentally ill continues to increase as a percentage of our overall incoming inmates, you may not see a decline in the number of assaults tied to individuals who've been diagnosed with mental illness because we have more of them at the end of the biennium than we started with. So we can try to find some ways to measure what those impacts are going to be, but they're complicated, driven both by the number of people coming into the system with diagnosis as they roll in and their own acuity levels, which, again, as Mr. Kuniak pointed out, change while we've got them and don't have a lot of ability to control what they show up with. So, but we'll work on something and try to come back to the committee maybe during the work session with some suggestions about a performance measure we can build around this that will at least give you some sense of how this resource was going to have an impact.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that Mr. Bilotti put his thinking cap on. He could figure out a way to track some outcomes here.
You have greater confidence in Mr. Bilotti than I do, Mr. Chair. And I have a lot of confidence.
Anybody can explain to me how a Cox regression analysis works.
Chair, and Max, I just really appreciate your response and the, your understanding of the complexities. And I guess what I'm sort of wrestling with, we're working on another project creating a juvenile PSRB, and kind of how, you know, our, you know, from a big picture, how systems approach. And obviously, you know, if we're seeing, it concerns me that we're seeing inmates, frankly, with this level of acuity in the system. To me, that says, well, obviously, we've got a mental health system that's not working, but also then, are, you know, is there another system out there that's not working as well? And just, you know, concerns about that. So, anyway, I just really appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
And your sensitivity to these issues.
All right, we do need to get to the grant proposal. I'm afraid Ginger probably is going to have to come back for another day. How would you like to proceed?
I did have, Mr. Chair, one more policy package on page 41 that shouldn't take too long, and
right.
I would do the grant, which I believe is Mark is the executor.
Okay, Chair Shields and members of the committee. Policy option package 21, titled Groundwater Monitoring, provides funding for operational and monitoring costs related to environmental monitoring of the Department of Environmental Quality's mandated groundwater contamination cleanup around the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. Our General Services Division receives part of this funding. Total package is $419,000. The Operations Division receives $194,000 of this. This money is involves no positions or FTEs. The Operations Division's portion of this policy package covers all facilities, maintenance, as well as training of staff to meet federal guidelines for safety. And this package relates to our key performance measure number 6, which is the rate of workers' compensation time loss claims per 100 employees on a fiscal year basis. I would also like to advise the committee that it is estimated that this particular process that we're talking about here today will be operated for the next 8 to 10 biennia. So we're looking at a very long-term process yet.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Sam, how does groundwater monitoring equal workers' compensation claims in terms of your key performance measure?
Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, we did have a malfunction of that system several years ago. I think it was around 5 years ago, where water that was supposedly being treated was being spilled onto the ground. We clearly at that time lucked out. We had it tested, we had it roped off, and it was found to be safe. But in the event that it wasn't safe, it could conceivably cause a health problem to not only to our staff that are in that area, but also there's also public housing right around that whole stripping area. So conceivably, if we're not following this process of making sure that that water is purified the way it's supposed to be purified, it could conceivably lead to some sort of a health problem.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, most of this money goes to training the staff who actually are responsible
right.
for doing the maintenance and monitoring of the facility that operates the groundwater. Our tieback to our key performance measure here, we recognize, is a little weak. We're attempting to do this in response to the specific instructions we got in the budget instructions to attempt to tie every policy option package back to a currently existing key performance measure. There's a lot of other things we could certainly measure with respect to this. For a number of years, this money was typically taken out of COP construction funding, and it has become a permanent fixture now in the program, and it will be for some period of time as we go through this process. We felt it was appropriate to try to move it over into this category of direct funding.
I appreciate the comment on the key performance measure. Somewhat of a facetious tone out of me on that, and I apologize.
No, we understand.
Okay.
I know it's not an excuse, Representative Hanna, but I would like to say we're, in this respect, sort of just following orders.
I appreciate that. The follow-up question is, do I understand this is surface water that we are monitoring, surface water from the facility?
Chair Shields and Representative Hanna, as I understand the process, it's water that's being pulled out of the ground to make sure, and then this goes through the stripping process where it's purified, and then it's put into the Mill Creek after it's been purified. And that's been going on now for 9-10 years.
And why are we pulling it out of the ground?
Several years ago, we had a situation at the penitentiary where they were dumping, and I don't know if it was accidental or if it was just part of a process, dry cleaning fluid into the ground, which got into the groundwater, caused a huge lawsuit, and now we're making sure that it's all pure.
I'm going to exercise the discretion of the chair and move on, because we do need to get this grant proposal approved so they can get to the full ways and means. So, Ms. Martin, if you could come forward.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. Chair Shield members.
And while Ms. Martin is coming forward, colleagues, I wanted to call your attention to a report that we copied and put in your desks regarding Senate Bill 267 compliance, which will be particularly relevant to Ms. Martin's whole presentation on transitional services and programs. And, Senate Bill 267 is the Evidence-Based Practice Act that passed out of Max Williams Judiciary in 2001 or 2003, perhaps.
Be careful what you wish for.
Now he has to live by it.
Mr. Chair, yes. As I recall, there was an indeterminate fiscal impact on the bill that would avoid a raise.
Imagine that.
I do recall, however, Mr. Chair, if I could just leave a small retort, that the chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee at the time, Representative Patridge, was in full support of the legislation and was sort of a co-author. So.
Well, we won't have indeterminate fiscal this time. Fire away.
Good afternoon. Chair Shields, members of the committee. I am Ginger Martin, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections, responsible for the Transitional Services Division. And I'm here to request retroactive authority to apply for a federal grant from the Department of Justice Bureau of Justice Assistance. The grant application is actually due January 11th, hence the retroactive request for authorization to apply. This particular grant opportunity was designed to fund pre-release services, good transition planning, and post-release coordination and monitoring services for offenders once they leave incarceration. The grant is for an amount up to $450,000 to last for 24 to 36 months and to serve 200 individuals. There's a 25% match that's required with the grant. That will be an in-kind match. The concept that we developed is to create a comprehensive transition program in the southern part of the state so that we could concentrate on the one regional releasing facility in the southern part of the state, which is Shutter Creek, and the five southern counties have agreed to participate with us in that grant. The idea is to provide in-prison assistance, coordination, preparation for successful community living, strong emphasis on employment readiness, and then to coordinate release planning between the in-prison individuals and the community individuals, and then to continue that linkage into the community with community corrections agencies providing both supervision and additional services for stability. So we would request that this grant application be authorized, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have about it.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to clarify what activities would be funded with this money.
Mm-hmm.
In the memo that I'm looking at, it uses the words assessment and planning, and I heard you mention post-release monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
That all sounds like the analytical side of things, but not actually the doing it part, the training or the curriculum or the programs. But then in some explanation in the latter part of your presentation just now, you did refer to employment readiness. So does this or does this not include the actual counseling or training, or is this really just the administrative side of things, the planning and the analysis and so forth?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, this is a service-oriented grant. It will bring a transition curriculum into that institution where none exists now, and that's where we get to the job skills, the ready-to-rent program that helps people be good renters and find employment, makes them more desirable to a potential landlord. Addressing stability needs like getting ID in place and links to the services in the community that they're going to need. In addition, we will bring into the prison the pre-employment services, employment readiness services. So the grant will pay for that transition coordinator inside, the development of a curriculum and the delivery of that curriculum, the contract with an employment specialist to come in also to serve the same population. And there's some additional funds that go out to the community corrections agencies to enhance what they're already doing. All of these community corrections agencies do have some transition services in place now. The grant allows them to perhaps add something they're missing. Each community has something. Not every community has everything. So it is, with the exception of a part-time administrative person to help coordinate getting the right offenders to that institution and doing data collection, the rest of the dollars are all service-oriented.
Any other questions from colleagues? Yep. By the way, I met with them and reviewed it, and I have a tendency to want to make sure that some funds end up going to community-based organizations in situations like that. It's been duly noted. So I have put a little bit of thought. I think it's a good idea. Senator Westlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators Brown and Burdick wanted me to ask you why Multnomah County isn't included on this. And how did these counties come together? I mean, what was the selection process?
Chair Shields, Senator Westlin. Multnomah County is participating with us in a very similar grant that also came from the same source. It's the same amount of money, and it's targeted to offenders releasing to Multnomah County. It's a companion grant to a grant that the Volunteers of America already received. So we are participating with Multnomah County as a partner in a transition and reentry program. This particular solicitation, because they were looking for a comprehensive approach, we wanted to stick with a particular region rather than Multnomah County is really service-rich at this point. So we were looking for another region that we could work with to make some improvement in our transition.
So can I assure Representative Burley and Wisnet that Deschutes County has a similar service?
Why don't we move on? There's a question on the table of whether or not to fund this grant proposal that's already been submitted. So, but your notion is well taken.
Fizz Brown and Burdick would like to vote.
Yes. All right.
And we'd also like to protest because we served under the glory days of the good Senator Neil Bryant, and we know, and the Representative Westlin is co-chair, and we know that Deschutes County is
well funded.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Motion, Representative Hanna.
Per capita, probably.
That this grant is approved in subcommittee and forwarded. Does it go to full ways?
Full ways means, yes.
Hearing in front of the full ways and means.
Thank you. Any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. I will need Carrier. I'd be happy to carry this one since I haven't done one yet in full ways and means. So anything else? And on Monday we will have public testimony. So please, colleagues, please be present for public testimony on Monday. A lot of people will be coming to testify. And any of you who are interested in testifying, if you could please let Mr. Wilson know so we can get a sense of how many days we may need. Lastly, we are going to be taking attendance. Just wanted to let you know that for future reference. Thank you.
Thank you.